There's no way I'm going to do the essential teachings of Jay Krishnamurti today. Because it's just too big. So I'm really going to focus on one of his teachings called Choiceless Awareness. That's going to be the focus. I think that's the heart of his teaching. But you're not supposed to really think about his teaching at all, according to him. You're supposed to just know the truth and live the truth. So you're just getting my opinion about the truth, and that's the best I can do. So how many of you are familiar with Krishnamurti? So just a couple. So let me give you a little bit of background. His birth and death date, this is the anniversary of his death. He died in 1986. He was born in 1895, so he lived quite a long life. Very unusual character. Probably, had he not been discovered by the Theosophists in India when he was a young boy, he probably would be unknown today. And that's my guess, that he is the product of, I don't know if you want to say an accident, but he is the product of this experience that happened with him when he was young, playing with his brother on the shore in Adyar in India, where the Theosophical Society had its headquarters. The Theosophists have been around for a long time. They were founded by Madame Blavatsky. So Madame Blavatsky, and now I'm backing up from one biography to another, but it's you gotta check her out. She's very interesting. There were a group of women in the late 1800s who just refused to fit in to the patriarchal norm of her time. And she was married to a Russian baron, where she got so she could call herself Madame, you know, Blavatsky, that she was this baroness. But she didn't like being married, and she didn't really like the guy, but she had a lot of money because of her marriage, and she just took off. And according to her, she went to Tibet. So there are other women who just went by themselves to Tibet at the time. Whether it's really true that they went to Tibet, or it's just sort of, you know, where have you been? Tibet, is what they say. But I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt. She went to Tibet. And I'm going to challenge something else in a minute. So in Tibet, she wanders around, and she meets the masters. So the masters are not geniuses at golf. That's a different master. They wear green jackets. The masters are these spiritual teachers who have been around forever, and they teach humanity the common truth of all religion that's at the heart of all religion. She meets these guys, and they start teaching her. And then she comes back into the normal world and starts sharing what she learned. And she wrote some amazing books. I don't understand any of it. A lot of it reflects late 19th century racism, and she's got all kinds of issues that she ascribes to the masters. Now, it's not any different than any other religious group where they take their biases and say, God said it, right? So it's the same idea. But if you cut through the stuff that is clearly late 19th century racism and bias and all that, you do find that she was in touch with something. Not necessarily someone, I don't know, but something. And this something led her to create the Theosophical Society. At the heart of the Theosophical Society are three core missions. Let's see if I can remember them. I am a member, but I often forget. The first one is the exploration of the common truths, or the truths common to the world's religions. So from the very beginning, they were about interfaith study. The second one is creating a world community based on those common themes. And the third one, which I think is the most interesting and still maybe the most unique among all the, because everyone's doing world community and everyone's doing, you know, interfaith study. The third one was developing the innate the innate capacities of the human mind to transcend what the human mind or the human brain defines as normal. So paranormal psychic abilities. And when I joined the Theosophical Society a few years ago, I was invited to lecture there, which was a shock because I thought they were all dead. But because I knew about them when I was little, and I just thought, you know, when I was young. But anyway, they're not dead. They have a thriving organization, a global organization. And I was intrigued with this whole idea of these paranormal psychic abilities that we have. There's no, unfortunately, though, I couldn't find a class where they actually taught these things, but it's still one of their missions. Madame Blavatsky dies. Her replacement is another incredible woman named Annie Besant. Annie Besant was British, Blavatsky was Russian, and she was very politically involved in the, I guess what you might call back then, women's liberation, but also India's liberation from the British rule. And in her time as leader of the Theosophical Society, there was this conviction that the masters were going to send a world teacher to lead humanity into a new age. This is all now early 19th century. They didn't know who it was, so they searched around. And different people put up their kids, oh, here, my kid is the world teacher, and, you know, because it would be cool to have, you know, the world teacher. I'm putting my 3-year-old grandson in the running for the 15th Dalai Lama when the 14th dies. I want to have his name in the running because it's cool, right? It's just cool. So, plus, it would mean that his family would have to move to India and I wouldn't have to deal with them, which is also pretty cool. No, that's not true. I just thought of that, but that's never speak stream of conscious. I learned my speaking skills from Donald Trump. It just comes out. So anyway, they're looking for this world teacher, and there are people in the running. But then one of their leaders, Charles Leadbeater, saw Krishnamurti and his brother playing on the beach. And for some reason, he just knew that Krishnamurti was the world teacher. Krishnamurti didn't know it, but Leadbeater. So they went to Krishnamurti's dad and said, look, we think you're, who was was part of the Theosophical movement. And they said, we want to raise your son to be the world teacher. We think he is the world teacher. We want to give him the education he needs to cultivate that. So dad says, if you take both my kids, then fine, right? So they did. They took Krishnamurti and his brother, and it's a whole long, amazing adventure. But anyway, they took him into England and they gave the two of them the best British education possible. His brother thrived on it. Krishnamurti was only interested in girls, cars, and golf. He was not interested in all his lessons. But they steeped him in all this mystical stuff and certain kinds of practices about which little, if anything, is known. And he began to have these experiences, but they were horrifying experiences. Very, very painful experiences, extreme headaches that were so bad that I don't know what psychologists would say, but it sort of split his personality from the ego Krishnamurti, splitting the ego Krishnamurti from the world teacher Krishnamurti. And it was just very, very odd. And he writes a little bit about it, but it's, at least in my mind, it's very difficult to follow. But it was a horrific years and years of this practice. But eventually, he embodies whatever the ideal of the world teacher is. Annie Besant and the rest of them create a whole separate society, a society specifically designed to promote his teachings. And the original gathering of the society draws thousands of people. And he's supposed to come up on the stage and say, today I am the world teacher. Instead, he gets up on the stage and he says, today I'm dissolving the order. Today I am telling you there is no world teacher. Today I am telling you to think for yourself. And it caused, clearly, you can imagine, it caused tremendous turmoil in the Theosophical Society. I mean, he was their guy and then he rejected them. And there was real disconnect between him and them for a very long time. Though now, if you go to the Theosophical headquarters in Chicago, where he and Annie Besant actually laid the cornerstone of the building, I think, in 1922. They have a big portrait of him, and they've reconciled because he's famous. And why lose, you know, why lose, you know, a favorite son? So they've reconciled with him. Whether he is reconciled with them, that's another story, but he's dead. So they've reconciled with him. It's like when I went to Amsterdam and I went to the synagogue that excommunicated Baruch Spinoza in the 1600s. Now they have his portrait on the wall. They sell his books in the bookstore because they realize the only thing important about that community is that they put a ban against, you know, Baruch Spinoza. So they reconciled with him too because he's the most famous guy that ever was there. So everyone reconciles with anyone else if there's some money in it. a little too gross if there's some benefit. So that's today. But back then there was a real split. His problem was, and this is the topic that's in the his most famous saying that's in the brochure, in the program today, truth is a pathless land, by which he meant there's no method to get to truth, because truth isn't anywhere but here. So anything you do to follow the path of truth, and sort of what we just heard with Galil Gibran, you know, it's not that the soul is unfolding. Truth is just happening. You don't meet the soul. You don't walk with the soul. You are the soul. You are the truth. You don't find the truth. So there's no way to get it. If there's no way to get it, you don't need an organization. You don't need a religion. You don't need any. He was against all these things. And he was against taking on any students and people following him. And he lived up to that. It wasn't like a sham thing. Many people came to his lectures, but no one could legitimately call herself or himself a follower of Krishnamurti. That was against the whole thing. I discovered that the hard way. I went to Ojai, California, where he ultimately settled and died. And they have this wonderful Krishnamurti Foundation, and one of his schools is there because he built elementary schools around the world. And I asked them, I said, I'm a follower of Krishnamurti. Do you have any photographs I could have and hang on my wall? And they went apoplectic. Like, you don't get it at all, do you? And obviously I didn't. And I don't have any Krishnamurti photographs on my wall, but I have all the books with photographs in them. So I'm still, he's turning over in his grave if he weren't cremated. So, anyway. That's sort of who he is, this rebel, this radical. And I think, because I've been reading him since high school, and if you haven't read him or listened to his talks, it's easier to read than maybe listen, because he speaks very slowly. But if you haven't checked him out, I would absolutely encourage you to do that. His books are readily available. You can download transcripts of his talks. You can listen to him on YouTube. You can go to kfa.org, Krishnamurti Foundation of America, and there's all kinds of material there. So he's definitely worth listening to. And I think he speaks the truth. I was going to say I think he's on to something, but I think it's more than that. I think he's realized the truth. The Dalai Lama recognized him as an enlightened Buddha of our time. This guy is amazing. So I recommend you follow him. We're going to look at this one aspect of his teaching, which is this notion of choiceless awareness. So to make this work, you're going to have to accept, for argument's sake, and I'm looking to explore this more deeply with you during second hour, but just for argument's sake, let's make a distinction between brain and mind. Brain, I'm going to define as that aspect of us that makes choices. Mind is that aspect of us that is simply aware of what is. So mind provides this field of awareness. Brain then reduces it to something that it seems real to the brain, and then recognizes options within that subfield and makes choices between those options. You follow what I'm saying? So awareness is the entire thing, really no frame. Brain says this is what matters, and then makes choices within the field of what matters. All right, so we can just live with that. So the first question that Krishnamurti asks, and this is really how he does it, he asks questions, doesn't actually ask you for answers. He just asks questions and then answers it himself. But that's his lectures. In his dialogues, it's all Q&A. But anyway, We're going to start with the question, can the brain be free? Can it operate freely? Or is the brain always the subject of conditioning? Well, you may have your own sense of this, and we'll talk about it second hour, but let me just give you his. His understanding is the brain is always conditioned. So you can think of the brain more or less as your own sense of self, and that sense of self is conditioned. You're not free to do whatever you want. I mean, you're constrained by stuff that, by biology, by genetics, but even more, and this is really what Krishnamurti is concerned about, is by the psychological conditioning that we receive from our parents and our teachers and our churches, you know, religions, our societies, our, you know, all the people who tell us what's what. Even if you don't agree with what person X says, you agree with what person Y says. You never actually think for yourself. Not because you're dumb, but because you're incapable, because the brain is incapable, because the self that is the brain is nothing without all that conditioning. Right? I mean, just make sure you're, again, you don't have to agree, but I need you to understand so I can walk you through this. So Rami is nothing without the conditioning that makes Rami Rami, starting with my name, starting with that I'm, you know, that I'm Jewish, and all the things that my parents told me, and all the things that my rabbis told me, and all this stuff, that whether I accept it today or not, conditions my thinking. Even if I reject it, it's still there. It still conditions my thinking, even in the negative. You know, they taught me X, I don't believe that for a minute. But just having to wrestle with not believing it limits my field of options. So he's saying the brain / egoic self is not free. It just is conditioned to be what it is. The conditioning happens in two ways. First, remember, awareness is awareness of the whole thing. First, the brain is conditioned only to see the stuff that matters to you, whatever that might be. And whatever that might be is dependent on conditioning. So you've got the big field, then you've got the lesser field that's already conditioned, and then within the lesser field there are the issues that you wrestle with, but you wrestle with them because of your conditioning. If you weren't so conditioned in a certain way, the things that bother you wouldn't bother you. So just for example, I'm constantly annoyed by Israeli political stuff. You know, I go on Twitter. I shouldn't go on Twitter, but I go on Twitter, and I read the Israeli press, and the liberal press, I read Haaretz, that's the liberal paper, I go, oh, thank God, there really is hope. And then you read the rest of it, and you go, oh, no, there's no hope whatsoever. But my obsession with what is Israel doing never occurs to some, you know, guy in Myanmar. It's not his thing. He's more concerned about what the priests in Myanmar are doing to the Muslims, or, you know, maybe how, it depends on what side of the equation they are, but they're more concerned in Myanmar with what's going on in Myanmar. If you're a Muslim in Myanmar, that's one concern. If you're a Buddhist in Myanmar, that's another concern. And if you're a liberal Buddhist from Myanmar, you're as obsessed about what the Myanmar government is doing as I am about what the Israeli government does. But what happens in Myanmar doesn't really bother someone who lives, you know, who's a Canadian. But that's because nothing bothers Canadians. But so maybe that was a bad example. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just condition. So I'm obsessed with Trump. But if I lived in Japan, I wouldn't be so obsessed with Trump. It's all about condition. So that's what the brain does. So even the things you wrestle with are part of your conditioning. Then within the things you wrestle, you have to make a decision. Do I tweet back? Right? So the president tweeted something about this morning, about, in all caps, you know, the so-called media is the enemy of the people. And then I said, should I say something? Do I have to say anything? What? Who cares what I say? But I did it, because I'm like conditioned to respond. And I responded in all caps. And my all caps thing was, the true enemy of America is Donald J. Trump, right? You know, that's is it J? I think it's J. But Donald Trump is the true enemy of America, in all caps. Right? So I'm conditioned to do that because I'm a liberal. So if I were, I mean, I have neighbors, they don't think that way. They hate the true enemy of the people, which is the New York Times, right? Which I get every morning thrown on my, you know, on my front step, and you can see people walk on it. There's like footprints on the bag. Ah, drive it out, right? So it's all part of our conditioning. Is there anything that isn't? All right, so if the brain and the self that's really defined by the brain, if that is completely conditioned, is there an aspect that is not? So he says the mind is not conditioned. The mind is simply your capacity to see the entirety of what's going on without judgment, without judgment, without seeing conflict, without making choices. The mind, the brain makes choices, the mind is choiceless. And that's where his term choiceless awareness comes from. But choiceless doesn't mean inactive. I'll come to that. So one of the examples that someone writing about him gave to explain this notion of awareness is driving a car. So when you drive a car, there are, I don't know how many, but I would bet thousands of things that you have to be aware of to get from point A to point B. But if you were consciously aware of them, you have an accident, right? I mean, do you ever have that experience where you get in the car and you're going somewhere and you get there and you have no idea how you got there? How many people have had that experience? Yeah, you should stop driving. That's very dangerous, right? That's not good. But that's the idea, that there's so many things happening, and if you were aware of them individually, you'd have an accident because you'd be distracted. You'd be, oh, watch out for that over there, and you'd miss this over here. So somehow you have this capacity, which he's calling mind, to simply be aware of all of it and interact with all of it seamlessly. Now, there are accidents, clearly, right? But most of the time, for most drivers, you're just going through and doing this dance with, you know, physics and gravity and people and other cars. All this stuff is happening, and you're just dancing, and you're not thinking about it. Some of us, because we're texting, but don't do that either. You're not thinking about it because thinking about it would get in the way of doing it successfully. Right? You get that idea? We're just in the flow. It's what the Chinese call wei wu wei, which means acting without acting. Because wu is the negative, so acting, wu, not, wei, acting. Acting, not acting. It makes sense to the Chinese people. But in English, the best translation of wei, wu, wei in English is non-coercive action. You're not making anything happen through your will. You're allowing everything to happen and working with the happening in order to achieve a goal or you know, whatever it is. And the example they often use in Chinese Taoism is a butcher cutting, you know, meat off a bone, and how they have their ideal butcher. It probably has a name in Chinese, I don't remember, but he never has to sharpen his blade because he never hits the bone. He always knows exactly how to carve and get all the meat off without hitting anything that would damage the blade. That's their ideal, that you have this capacity to interact with what's happening in such a way as to do no damage and yet maximize your effectiveness, whatever you're trying to achieve. That's the mind in operation. So then you have to ask the question, is the mind free? So the answer to the question, is the brain free, is no. The brain is conditioned. Is the mind conditioned? Again, these are questions we're going to raise together, Gesundheit. But from Krishnamurti's point of view, the mind is free. There is simply awareness. And when you're in that state of awareness, which you always are, but the brain is limiting it and creating conflict. Look out, watch out, do this. If you're, when you're in that state, consciously in that state of awareness, when you're aware of being aware, then it's what he calls choiceless awareness. But again, choiceless doesn't mean inactive. So where the brain says in its condition box, here's a problem, there's a problem, what'll I do? And then the brain has certain solutions to apply to problems that are also conditioned solutions. And I'll go to lots of churches, not UU, but you know, more mainstream, you know, real Christian churches, where they're scared of hell, those kinds of churches. And they're obsessed with original sin. I love going to those places because my talk is oftentimes on how to free yourself from original sin. And the easiest way to free yourself from original sin is to become a Jew or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Unitarian, because we don't have those things. So you're worried about original sin because when you were a little kid, someone told you you have original sin. So the field of awareness is suddenly reduced to a field of sinfulness. And then within that field of sinfulness, there are all these sins in different ranking. And you may or may not have done this one or that one or the other one. And you got to figure, oh my God, I did it, or how do I avoid doing it? And your entire world is defined by a concept that only exists in the narrative of a specific conditioned ideology. Mind is something else. Mind sees what is, and mind simply knows what to do without choosing what to do, hence choiceless. So when you're, just one example, I'm not sure if it's a great one, but if you dance, now if you dance with a partner, and it's even more true, but there's only so many bones in my wife's feet that I can break, so that's not a major thing for us. But if you dance with a partner, you have to be completely aware of the movements of your partner, the movements of other people in the room, if there's other people dancing, the rhythm, the whole thing. But if you try to think about all those things, you just step on feet. You're not dancing. You're stomping or whatever it is. You know, just making a mess of things. But if you are simply aware of all the factors that are at play in the dance, then you just move, and there's just a grace to it. The same thing if you're dancing alone, right? If you think about what you're doing, it looks terrible. If you just move with the music, you know, you're like AOC, right? Dancing in the halls of Congress, right? So, if you don't, you know who AOC is? Yeah, good, because I don't. But I forget her Octavio AOC. So that's what he's talking about when he's talking about mind. If he's right, and we're just going to go with the fact that, you know, we're going to go with that assumption that he's right. If he's right, we've got to shift from brain to mind, except you can't. Truth is a pathless land. Living from mind, you can't say, okay, I get it. I got to get from this to this. How do I do that? Well, already you're stuck in this, because the brain is just going to figure out more choices that are already conditioned, and mind is unconditioned. You cannot deliberately move from self with a little s to self with a big s, or brain to mind. It just doesn't work. There's nothing you can do. The disconnect between knowing in a deep way that you need to make the shift from the narrow to the spacious, and also knowing that there's no way to make the shift from the narrow to the spacious, you're in an absolute double bind. When you truly understand you're in a double bind, right, you know what that means? You damned if you do and damned if you don't. There's nothing you can do, including doing nothing. When you're in that extreme double bind, the brain breaks. This is not Krishnamurti life. I'm just paraphrasing. The brain breaks. In other words, the conditioning stops. In my case, Rami ends. All the thoughts, all the stuff that defines me just stops. Not because I'm choosing to stop it. Not because I'm meditating my way into emptiness, which is also, you know, impossible from this point of view. It simply stops because it's impossible to maintain it in the with the awareness that it is conditioned and I'm trying to get unconditioned. The very struggle, the tension between brain and mind is such that brain simply cracks. It's an act of grace, if you like. Brain simply cracks and mind happens. And when mind happens, you know so clearly what is going on that doing becomes choiceless, effortless. Just like when you're driving a car. You know everything that's going on, not consciously, because that would be impossible. But you're aware of thousands of different factors, and you know, and you're constantly adjusting the wheel just a little bit. I don't know if you've ever done it consciously, maybe when you first learned to drive. You're going, okay, I gotta turn this way. Ah, no, that was too much, I gotta go back. You don't do that, you're just dancing with the traffic, right? And most of the time that works. Now, is it that there was just that 47 car pileup somewhere in Illinois, was it? But that was because the conditions were such that you couldn't see anything. You didn't know what was going on. So, but in the scenario that I'm laying out here, when you see what's happening, you happen with it, and it's effortless, and it's conflict-free from his point of view. And the right always happens because you know not what the right thing is, because then that's like the right thing and a wrong thing. You just know what's happening, and there's only one way to deal with it. Now that's the challenge of the whole notion of choiceless awareness. There's no choice. So it's not a matter of free will. It's not like the brain has no free will, but mind does. There is no free will. The brain has the illusion of free will. I have this choice and that choice and this choice. I'm gonna make a choice between them freely. It's not true because your choices are conditioned, not only the choice of choices, but which one you choose. But awareness is not free because once you know what's happening, you can only do the thing that is the right thing. But you wouldn't say right necessarily. So now what do you do with that? Right? So can that happen? Krishnamurti says it happens to us all the time. We just don't label it as anything important, like driving. Can it happen? So yes, it can happen when, and I'm going to leave you with this, and we can talk about it in a second now, when you allow the conflict to become so intense that you stop. Your brain stops. When you push the brain to the limit, and then it just cracks and crumbles. And then the truth is just there, because the truth is always there. So happy anniversary of the passing of Krishnamurti. Happy President's Day. Second hour, we'll talk more about this. Third hour, you should go buy a mattress, because that's how we celebrate President's Day.